Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we get a lesson in zombie survival with the St. Louis-based Zombie Squad. We hear about the band The Moonrays, who have based their career on Halloween songs. And we have our annual chat with a ghost hunter. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. All over the country, groups of young classical musicians have begun playing in bars, like any other young band trying to make it. The result has been phenomenal. Packed bars full of cheering fans. Young people do like old music after all, it turns out. You just have to bring it to them. Nathaniel Johnson went to check out the people who started this classical revolution in San Francisco.
This is the sound of San Francisco's Mission District on any given night. But if I just step inside Socha Cafe here, the soundscape changes. Five musicians in their 20s and early 30s are seated in a semicircle playing stringed instruments. Around them, people are drinking beer and chatting. It's probably a lot noisier than the last live classical performance you went to. But then again, here you can get a lot closer. And the performers seem to be having more fun. As the viola makes a little motif, he dips his shoulder as if to toss it to the cello. Here. And she... raises her eyebrows and tosses it back with a little nod of her head. Many of these people are professional musicians, like violinist Jory Fancuccia.
And the idea is sort of to bring classical music to an audience that doesn't usually get to hear it. You know, I've always wanted to sort of, you know, like play for people in sort of like a, you know, more intimate and play for people that are sort of my own age, that weren't like at least three times my own age.
He doesn't have anything against the older music lovers. It's just that Fancuccian started to get depressed when he saw audiences get older and older year after year. But when he started playing in bars, he found a totally different crowd.
It's been refreshing because people are totally into it. You know, like people go nuts for it, and it makes you realize you're like, oh yeah, it is kind of, the music is cool. It's just the venues aren't always very cool. And you have to pay so much money, most of these people can't go, right? And you have to get dressed up, you have to be quiet, you can't drink beer while you're watching, you can't, you know, all these things. And I mean, I get uncomfortable sometimes in a concert hall, and I'm a classical musician, right?
Cherith Premawardhana started the group in September of 2006. They played every Sunday in San Francisco's Revolution Cafe. Premawardhana says people were into it.
More audience started coming out, more musicians started coming out to play, really good musicians started coming out to play. There's this girl, Anakiko Myers, who's a concert violinist. She plays all around the world for sold-out concert halls and stuff. That was our first kind of high-profile person who came in. Since then, we've had people from, you know, San Francisco Opera, San Francisco Symphony, San Francisco Ballet, Atlanta Symphony, Berlin Philharmonic.
So these are people that are, they're like on they're playing here,
yeah.
And they'll hear about this and stop by?
Or yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the guy from Atlanta Symphony was doing a show here with some of these guys, you know. And so he was around, and it's just a kind of a word-of-mouth, like, networking thing.
And I assume you're making just tons of money hand over fist from this
money
type of thing.
Yeah, no money. No, but, you know, it's just for fun, you know. We make our money doing our gigs, which are usually shitty and boring. And then we have things we can do, and it's just fun, and we can drink, and we can, you know, do whatever we want and just have fun playing music. And the people who listen to us are not people who are playing tons of money, you know, who we need to try to impress. but like people who are our peers, you know, and who are as drunk as we are or more, you know. That's...
That story from Nathaniel Johnson. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. There's a training program in Chicago that's so elite, it accepts a lower percentage of people than Harvard. The Ryan Opera Center is an arm of Chicago's lyric opera that develops rising young singers. And getting in can increase the chance of becoming a star someday. Chicago Public Radio's Lynette Kalsness follows one of the aspiring singers through her first season.
Katie Lemus is surrounded by boxes on a rainy April day. She came here from Indiana University, where she got her master's in music. She moved here only days before starting her new job as a mezzo-soprano at the Ryan Opera Center. The stakes are high. If she does well, by the end of a few years, she'll likely have dozens of auditions, a manager, and maybe even some roles lined up. But first, she's got to unpack.
I'm nervous, but I'm excited. You know, it's a big, big, big opportunity, especially to be young. You know, I'm 25, just getting out of my master's degree, and it's kind of like having a mini job. And, you know, I want to make a good impression, and I intend on working hard. And hopefully that'll lead to jobs later on.
Okay, off on the tour we go.
The first day at the Ryan Center starts with the usual tedium. Introductions, security badges, and, of course, the tour.
Here's a kitchen. As is obvious.
It culminates on the Lyric Opera's stage. The singers wander to the edge of the stage and look up into the glittering gold theater.
What do you think?
Wow.
It's exciting.
It's big.
Have you guys seen it from this angle before?
Yes. Well,
our finals were here, but it's still really damn cool.
The last time bass baritone Craig Urban and Lemus stood here, it was last fall, final auditions. About 400 people a year try out for the Ryan. Only about a dozen make it. The program's director is Jana Rolandi.
You can listen to 40 people in a day, and they're all good, and you're writing good and possible, then one of them will come in, and the mouth will open, and everybody sits up, and the hair stands up on the back of your neck, and you don't even write anything down. And there it is.
Those like Lemus who make the cut get paid to take voice lessons, learn about great singers of the past, and attend master classes with some of opera's living legends. After several months of training, the members become understudies and even play roles at the Lyric.
The time between, say, college or grad school and then really being able to support yourself full time is a terrible, terrible sort of no man's land to try to find an agent and to get auditions. And we provide a bridge.
Katie Lemus's path to this moment started 25 years ago.
My parents used to put me to sleep when I was a baby to the classical station. And I actually sang. I would match pitch before I ever spoke a word. And my parents said, maybe we should put her in some kind of music. So they did.
And I was first, it was the church preschool choir. Later, it was the Columbus, Ohio Children's Choir. Then came high school musicals.
Can you even remember a time you weren't singing?
No. Even when I was little, I'd sing to myself while I was playing with my Barbies. So, to be honest, no. I always sing.
Did you make up the songs?
Yeah. I'm a little embarrassed to say so. And sometimes I recorded them. Now, I don't think I have any, so don't get excited.
Lemus's love of music goes back generations. One of her grandfathers was a machinist who tuned into the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts every week. A few years ago, Lemus discovered this tape of him singing.
If I could tell you the thoughts I cherish and all the ways you are dear to me.
Lemus's grandfather died without knowing that his granddaughter would become an opera singer. For the next several months, Lemus attends voice coachings once or twice a day.
Sometimes the way, just little teeny things like the way you're rolling an R or something like that is making a syllable come out that I don't think you want to come out.
Okay.
There are German diction lessons and rehearsals for hours at a time. Okay, we all know the reputation of opera singers as divas. At the Ryan Center, that doesn't exist. In the dressing room, before a small private performance of Marriage of Figaro, the women warm up. They tighten each other's corsets. They even help style each other's hair.
So describe to me what you're doing to your hair right now.
I'm destroying it. And I don't think deep conditioning is going to help. I'm teasing my entire head. It's going to be kind of a weird couture. My opinion of Marcellina is that she wants to be like the Contessa, whose hair is perfect, but she doesn't quite reach that.
I'm just watching you, and all I can think of is ouch.
Then it's performance time. Originally, Katie Lemus had her sights set on Broadway.
And actually, I auditioned at 6 undergraduate schools after high school for musical theater, but ironically, no one took me for that. They all took me for voice. So it could be because I couldn't dance, you know?
So she ended up here, trying to advance her career as an opera singer. She represents the next generation of the art form.
I mean, I can't even tell you how many times people ask me, well, what do you do? And I say, I'm an opera singer. Oh, I've never been to an opera. And I think, go experience it just once. It's really amazing. And you can see one of the classic operas and just fall in love with it just from that one opera.
All of the Ryan members hope to have careers as opera singers, but they all realize it's not going to be easy. It's going to mean a lot of travel and moving every few months. Despite the challenges, Lemus looks forward to a long career in opera.
I'm excited to do that, but I hope that I can have everything else that comes along with life, you know, and not just the career.
For instance?
Marriage, kids, you know. A big house with a yard, that'd be nice. But, you know, I'm a Midwestern girl, so I want all those things. But I love what I do, and I'm really happy doing it. And I think as long as I stay happy, you know, I think that'll be the most important thing.
Finally, it's opening night at Lyric Opera. A maintenance worker vacuums the red carpet, and a ballet dancer twirls around on the sidewalk. Lemus arrives at the stage door carrying her ball gown for later on. She's just 2 hours away from her debut in Manon.
I'm thrilled. You know, I'm thrilled to be here and to be a part of it. I'm just really excited, and I feel like all the preparation has gone really well, and this is it. You know, it's going to be fun.
Lemus takes the stage in long green robes with a tight corset, and she unleashes the voice she's been developing since childhood. I'm Lynette Kalsnes, Chicago Public Radio.
This is Sidetrack. You're listening to Sidetrack. For the Moonrays, a band based out of Chicago, this is the time of year they live for. They have built their career out of mixing Halloween music with swing, surf, lounge, and jazz. It all started with their recreation of a TV horror show theme. They have recently released their fourth CD, Swinging at the Seance. It's a collection of Halloween jump blues and swing songs from the 1930s and 1940s. It's released by Sound Video Impressions / Sound Imp Records. I recently talked to Scott Menching from the band and asked him how this new album came to be.
We were deciding what to do that could be different than anything we did before. So, you know, we sort of hit the Mancini spy surf stuff on the first album, and the second album we had hit the, spaghetti western and some of the old TV theme type of tones. So, we're still hunting around for Halloween music, and I actually came across a few old records one day, and Bing Crosby, Headless Horseman in this. And so I was talking with a buddy of mine who actually wasn't in the band, and he was like, wouldn't it be cool to remake, you know, some of these old 40s Halloween tunes? And I was like, yeah. That might be pretty cool to remake some of those. So we started digging around and found out that there is a lot of material out there.
Well, all of your albums, as you pointed out, have this theme of Halloween and Halloween-type music. What is it about that type of music that draws you to it?
Well, it was a creature features thing. We just sort of got snowballed into it, really. It was, we were working under the name of the Atomic Martinis in the mid-90s, and it was during that whole cocktail craze. And Bill Holtane, that owns SVI, and I were talking about, it was near Halloween, as a matter of fact. It's probably been like 2000, something like that. And we started talking about these old shows that were on, Vampire and Shock Theater and all this, and Creature Features came up, and we decided to redo that, because I had the opening on a reel-to-reel, and it was fun. I mean, we went in, and we did the overdubs, and laid the basic tracks down, and then did the vocal part that Marty McNeely, the newsman, used to do on the show years ago. And it got some airplay on Halloween. There were a number of stations that picked it up, and it was getting play on the web, and it got a few regular stations were playing it. And it was because of that that Bill decided that he might like to do a full album of that has the same feel. We never set out to be a Halloween band. It's just we sort of ended up in this niche, and it's cool, you know. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of bands out there doing it, and it comes around every year, so, you know, we enjoy it.
Well, let's get back to the creature features. For those who don't know about it, it was a TV show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so explain what this was.
It was a Saturday Night Spook Show, and it didn't even have a horror host. Like, you know, Sven Gulli was in Chicago, and that was more of a legitimate, you know, horror host. He'd have guests on, and this was just a voiceover with a montage of old Universal Monster movie clips done to Henry Mancini's Experiment in Terror. And then they wrote a poem, and the newsman read this poem in, like, a spooky voice. And they'd show old movies on Saturday night at 10:30. And everyone in Chicago was addicted to it in the 70s. You know, it was just, it came after the whole shock theater package. But it was, you know, I mean, I grew up on it, and all my friends did. But what was interesting about this is when we decided to do it, I wanted to make sure we could get the rights for it, simply because it was like a WGN property. Even though the song was a Mancini tune, you know, and we filed for the mechanical rights for that, I wanted to make sure there was going to be no problem with WGN. So to show how far out of the psyche this show was at the time, I called WGN and asked them for any information they had, and they referred me to Linkin Park Zoo. You know, so I have no idea why what they were thinking, but so obviously they had no interest or you know, anything legally binding with that show anymore. So we recorded it, and after we recorded it, there were websites that popped up about it, and a book written about it, and it was just kind of really an interesting phenomenon.
Well, I have a copy of your song right here. From your first album, Thrills and Chills, and let's hear it, okay?
Sure.
That's a bit of Creature Features, the Mancini tune Experiment in Terror with a twist. And we're talking to Scott Menching of the band The Moonrays, and they have recently released a new CD filled with old jump blues and swing-based Halloween music. And let's get back to that album. What is it about the feel of this sort of music that really draws you to it, as opposed
swing?
To well, the Halloween, the spooky songs, as opposed to straight ahead jazz or swing?
Well, I love swing. I grew up on it. My father was a big band musician, and I have always loved it. And it's part of that music. But I mean, Halloween is like a fun holiday. You know, it's the it's not as much for kids anymore as it is for adults. I mean, there's a lot of money in it, and the parties and things like that. It's, so this music kind of we wanted to pick songs that we'd say, okay, would this sound good at a Halloween party? You know, and that's how we kind of went with this, was to say, okay, well, it's swing music, but would it be good for a Halloween party? Because, you know, we want people to throw it on when they're, you know, having a good time and have it add to the experience. So I don't know, to answer your question, is it better than regular swing? No, it's just another type of the same music, but a good song is a good song, you know.
So is Halloween your favorite holiday, or have you grown to love it more because of the band?
Well, it's big around here, yeah, especially the neighborhood kids know what I do, and, you know, they're all looking for CDs at Halloween. So, yeah, you know, it's, yeah, it's, I like Halloween. I mean, Halloween and Christmas, you know, the whole holiday season I enjoy, but, you know, it's, the word gets out.
So are there any other genres you guys want to explore, Halloween-based?
Yeah. That's the question. I mean, to try and think of, I think we've pretty much hit every kind of Halloween music there is without going back to, like, folk music, you know, and or Delta Blues, maybe. That might be, you know, about the only thing left, you know, but going back to, like, you know, the real early Supernatural type stuff, but I don't know if we would do that. If we were going to do another one, if this one really would sell, there was more than enough material to, you know, probably do a follow-up to this of lots and lots of good songs from back then.
Well, if people want to find out more about your latest album, Swinging at the Sands, or about the other albums the Moonrays have, where should they go?
They should go to www.moon-rays.com or check us out on MySpace. That's Moonrays, myspace.com/Moonrays.
That was Scott Menching from the band The Moonrays. Their latest release is titled Swingin' at the Seance. Here's a cut from the album, Haunted House Blues. It's a song originally recorded by Bessie Smith in 1923.
Thank you. countryside. At precisely 12 o'clock, the spooks began to rise.
Haunted House Blues, as performed by the band The Moonrays. Still to come on the program, we get lessons in surviving a zombie invasion, and we talk to ghost hunter Troy Taylor. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. How many of you know what to do if you were forced from your home in a hurry with only what you could carry? Where would you go? What would you need to survive? What if the threat that pushed you out was a massive uprising of the undead? For the past 5 years, a group in St. Louis, Missouri has been preparing for just that. They call themselves the Zombie Squad. A self-described elite zombie suppression task force, they're not only ready to defend your neighborhood from hordes of walking dead, they also spend much of their time raising awareness about the importance of disaster preparation. Producer Adam Allington brings us this profile.
If you watch a zombie movie in some parts of St. Louis, it's definitely not a passive experience. Down at the old Esquire 7, people literally yell at the screen. But it's that kind of thing with zombie movies, isn't it? Even though it's totally out there, you've got to give the characters advice.
Yeah, he shouldn't have gone in there. You know, just going in the first place is stupid enough.
That's William Spencer. He's one of the founding members of Zombie Squad. The idea for the group arose after several friends watched the British zombie movie 28 Days Later. Basically, they thought if they were the ones running from the zombies, they could do better. I invited William Spencer and Michelle Hatfield over to watch 28 Days and point out a few examples of what not to do around zombies. In this scene from the film, the protagonist, Jim, walks into an eerily empty roadside diner.
Hello?
He was attacked by that crazy child.
Find anything?
No, let's get out of here.
What did he do wrong?
He went into an abandoned building when he's in what he knows to be a zombie situation, walks around next to a bunch of dead bodies and doesn't leave, and then doesn't tell his friends that he got attacked by a zombie.
This guy, not in Zombie Squad.
Zombie Squad is quick to point out that they started before Max Brooks published the infamous Zombie Survival Guide in 2003. Now they have over 300 dues-paying members. They like to say that if you're prepared to survive a zombie apocalypse, the so-called Zombocalypse, you're prepared for anything. They started hosting disaster preparedness workshops. Here they are speaking to about 150 people at a science fiction festival last year in St. Louis. Rule number one, in the midst of chaos, stay off the highway.
And you know what? To a zombie, a long strip of highway with a bunch of cars not moving, full of people, that's not a highway, that's a buffet.
But Zombie Squad aren't your garden variety survivalists. They don't have a political bent. They're actually pretty accessible and funny. And they have some really cool cars. Think something like Mad Max meets Shaun of the Dead.
This is our Zombie Squad truck.
Explain what we have here. We have a modified...
This is an 88 Dodge Dakota. I bolted metal plates all over it. It's pretty ready to go. The inside has diamond plate ammo cans on the side. I can show you. As of right now, it looks like I have some climbing rope, some toe straps, flashlight. There's a bottle of whiskey in here. It's got like a loudspeaker on the top for announcing.
Okay, but all of this kind of reminds me of the time my friends and I watched Lost Boys in fifth grade and decided we needed to carry sharp sticks in our backpacks, just in case, you know, we ran into some vampires on the school bus. Then at some point, what was it? Oh yeah, we remembered that vampires aren't real. Chris Sear is a member of Zombie Squad. He's actually the group's treasurer. Yes, he says, they know zombies aren't real. Still, somehow even the idea of zombies seems to tap into a general anxiety that lots of people have these days.
A zombie doesn't know why it wants to eat your face. It wants your face. That's why zombies work for Zombie Squad. Zombies aren't, you know, the Islamofascists. Zombies are zombies. And that's why a tornado doesn't care who you are. A tornado is not an Islamofascist. A tornado is a tornado.
So in their downtime from fighting the undead, which is, you know, all the time, in addition to the seminars, Zombie Squad also organizes charity film festivals, zombie walks for cancer, even blood drives like this one.
You've got a nice big juicy vein.
But before you put that big needle into my vein and take my life essence, you should know that I haven't done this since I was 18, and I'm pretty scared.
You'll do fine.
Okay, so I'm a little squeamish of needles, but judging from all their tattoos and piercings, most people in Zombie Squad aren't. Thankfully, the Red Cross actually relaxed its restrictions on tattoos several years ago. As long as your ink came from a certified parlor, you're good to go.
My name's Susan Beckerly with the American Red Cross. My affiliation with the Zombie Squad is to plan their blood drives. They're very successful blood drives. They started with receiving 25 units and we're up near 80 units at a drive.
Is that a lot?
That's a very successful blood drive. That's probably considered a big blood drive.
Beckerly says one of the reasons Zombie Squad's charity work is so impressive is that they're able to leverage a demographic that typically aren't joiners. Jennifer Spencer is a photographer. Her right arm has a tattoo of a black snake curling from her shoulder down to her forearm.
As far as actually donating blood, sort of being involved with my community, it was something that I would have liked to have done that I didn't do, so it sort of kick-started for me this idea of actually volunteering my time and making that effort.
I think the time was right for a group like ours.
That's William Spencer again, the guy who drives the zombie truck.
We really are just about helping people being prepared, community-oriented organizations, and people just want that they can just live in their normal world, feel safe, and help out their neighbors, and we don't add anything extra to it.
Really, zombies have always been metaphors. Whether you're talking about the prehistory Epic of Gilgamesh-type zombie or the 20th century George Romero social commentary-type zombie, they represent not only the very worst that could happen to society, but also just some of the normal, everyday stuff that threatens to take us over. Dennis Hopper had this take on it in Land of the Dead.
They're mindless walking corpses, and many of us will be too if you don't stay focused on the task at hand. Zombies, man. They creep me out.
I'm Adam Allington in St. Louis.
I walk with a zombie.
Every October on Sidetrack, we like to get into the Halloween spirit by talking to a ghost hunter. Troy Taylor is one such person. He is one of the founders of the American Ghost Society. He is also a writer and hosts several haunted tours around the state. We last talked to him about ghosts in 2005. I asked him first what he's been up to since then.
Actually, a lot of things have changed since the last time we talked. And as you know, this is the crazy time of year, Halloween for me. I think for a lot of people these days. But I really have changed a lot of things. I think I probably talked to you not long after I had moved back to Decatur from Alton, where I had been living for about 8 years. And we had started a tour company in Alton, the Alton Hauntings Ghost Tours. I moved back to Decatur, and since I've talked to you, I've taken back over the Haunted Decatur Tours. We started a new tour company down in Lebanon, which is down near Belleville. We started a new tour company in Jacksonville for ghost tours, and I started a tour company in Chicago for ghost tours since the last time I talked to you. So if things were crazy before at Halloween, they're really crazy now.
So you have all these tours going on. Do you still have time to go out and do investigations about hauntings?
Not so much in October, in this time of year, but through the rest of the year, yeah. Because, as I know you're aware, my writing is what I really do is my first and foremost thing. In fact, my 57th book just came out a couple weeks ago. So that's kind of key to the writing, is being able to go out and visit these places that I write about. I do. I do still go out. I still go ghost hunting. In fact, I was just last week, finally got a chance after quite a number of years to get into an abandoned insane asylum up in northern Illinois. It's been off limits for years, and was actually able to do some ghost hunting just last week. So, yeah, it is something I get to do on a pretty regular basis.
Well, tell us about that insane asylum.
Well, it's actually the old Bartonville, or the old Peoria State Hospital. But it's located in Bartonville, which is right outside of Peoria. And it's been closed down since about 1972. It was really probably one of the premier insane asylums in the state of Illinois. That sounds weird to say it that way, but it was a place where the patients really were given very good care. But I've always been of the idea that locations where there's, you know, a lot of trauma, whether it be physical or mental, or, you know, that trauma leaves an impression behind on the atmosphere of a place. So it's really not a surprise that the old Bartonville Insane Asylum, you know, has gotten a reputation for being haunted over the years. Even back in the years when it was still an asylum, there were actually ghost stories being told about it, including one about a former patient who was known as the Bookbinder, which is probably the most famous story of the hospital. And it was actually told by the hospital administrator, a guy named Dr. George Zeller. He was the man in charge of the hospital, and he actually witnessed the return of the Bookbinder's ghost at the cemetery on the day that he was buried, and wrote about it. And, to the day he died, maintained he had seen a ghost that afternoon. He, and along with about 100 of the staff members, saw this ghost. But over the years, there have been a lot of stories told of people seeing doctors and nurses still in the old building, you know, years after it had been abandoned, patients, weird sounds, apparitions, lights in the building when there was no electricity, that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's a very spooky place, what's left of it. There isn't a lot. A lot of the older buildings have been torn down now, but the Bowen Building, which was the main building, is still standing, and it is it's a massive place. And we actually got to spend most of the night there last Monday night, and didn't have a lot of activity. We did have a few weird things that happened. Some of the people who were there with me reported some footsteps that they heard down in the tunnels that run underneath the building to where some of the old buildings used to be. And we actually had a weird incident happen with this light that a friend of mine and I actually kind of followed through the building. We weren't able to see exactly what it was, but it was about waist high, about the size of a baseball, and we were actually literally following it down a hallway. And when we were trying to figure out if it was a light shining in from somewhere else, but we certainly couldn't track anything down. So jury's still out on that one. I can't tell you that it was a ghost, but it was a kind of a weird incident anyway.
Okay, now last time we talked for Halloween was back in 2005, and I asked you during that interview about New Orleans and Katrina. It had just happened that summer. Few years on, have you heard ghost stories coming from New Orleans in regards to Katrina?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you should bring that up, because I actually have heard quite a few stories post-Katrina about New Orleans, ones that have nothing to do with, you know, the old history of New Orleans and things. These are all seem to be new stories, not so much caused by the hurricane, but rather places that people are experiencing maybe for the first time or for the first time in many years because of the hurricane. A lot of the stories I've heard have been from, or at least that I was hearing, I'm not hearing so much now that things have kind of settled back more to normal, but for a while was hearing stories from National Guard guys, firefighters who had gone down to volunteer and that kind of thing, who, you know, were telling stories about some of the places they were bunking. Old schools, old buildings, they were having, you know, they were seeing ghosts, they were hearing things. Couple of guys, some firefighters that I knew from Northern Illinois, were telling me about that they were actually bunked in an old school, and up on the second floor, they were staying in one of the classrooms in bunks, and then helping out during the day, and then they would go back there to sleep at night. And they said that they would hear footsteps and voices and stuff on, I mean, going on to the point that it was almost all night long, that finally all of the guys who were bunking on the second floor all moved down to the first floor. Nobody would go back up to the second floor again. So a lot of these stories did come up after Katrina, and it'll be interesting to see if, you know, some of those stories continue to be told or if they were just sort of a short-lived thing.
Now, last year you published the 10th anniversary edition of your Ghost Hunter's Guidebook. Now, did you add anything new to it, and how has ghost hunting changed over the decade?
Well, actually, there was a lot of new additions to the Ghost Hunter's Guidebook. Every time a new edition comes out, that was, I think, number four, actually. And every time a new edition comes out, I always add in a lot of new stuff because things do change quite a bit. I mean, things that people were sure, you know, were related to ghosts, you know, 10 years before, now we're thinking not so much. Things like orbs, you'll hear people talk about orbs even today. 10 years ago, we thought that this was something really bizarre and unusual, but now we really think that it's mostly just dust and pollen and bugs, and, you know, there's usually a logical, 99.9% of the time, there's a logical explanation for an orb that shows up in a photograph. But that's something that we didn't know 10 years ago. There's been a lot of changes in equipment in the last 10 years, things that people can use as far as recording devices. I mean, cameras have changed drastically. Digital cameras were really, at least for the general public, sort of in their infancy, so to speak, 10 years ago. People were just starting to use them, weren't really sure how they all, you know, everything about them and how they worked. You know, 10 years later, that's just about all anybody uses anymore is digital cameras. And we, you know a lot more about them and what to look for and what not to look for and how to kind of, you know, debunk things that maybe we would have been taken in by 10 years ago. So, you know, it just, you know, a lot of things have changed. In addition, that book is just about to be translated into Russian. I was just recently contacted by a Russian publisher who wants to do a Russian edition of the Ghost Hunter's Guidebook. So go figure.
Well, on your website, prairieghosts.com, you recently posted an article titled What to Do When Your House is Haunted. Talk to us a little bit about the advice you offer up in that article.
Yeah, I actually posted that last year, and it got picked up by This Old House and or Old House Journal. I don't know, one of the two of them, and got spread all over the place, which was kind of interesting. But if the article really just, you know, we get a lot of calls from people who think their house might be haunted, you know, and unfortunately, you know, 8 or 9, sometimes 9 times out of 10, it really isn't haunted, that there may be a logical explanation for what's going on. And so the article really is something that kind of takes people through what to do if they think their house is haunted, keeping track of things that happen, writing everything down, you know, making a note of everybody who was present at the time, who saw what, you know, exactly when it happened, what night of the week it was, what date it was, because these are all things that, you know, that a good ghost hunter would ask you to do before they even came to visit you at your house anyway. when people want you to come out and investigate their house, these are usually things I ask them to do ahead of time, is to keep a journal and write down everything they can think of. And that's a really good place to start. And then, you know, the article then goes on to kind of direct people on how to find a legitimate ghost hunter. You know, what, you know, do they have a website? What's on their website? You know, are they, you know, do they seem legit? Do they, are they working with somebody else? Is there a way to check them out? You know, because, I mean, you have to think about this. You know, maybe your house is haunted, maybe it's not. Regardless, you're going to be asking pretty much complete strangers to come into your house and invade your space. And the article talks about that, too, how invasive a legitimate ghost investigation can be. You've got people coming in, taking pictures and cameras and, you know, and equipment and spending a lot of time in your house, and you got to make sure that this is somebody that you're really going to want in your house. So, I've met a lot of really great people out there who are, you know, involved in this field going out hunting for ghosts, and I've met some really, really strange people, too, that, truthfully, I wouldn't want in my house. So, you know, I that's what the article's all about, just trying to help people, you know, make a decision on what they want to do.
When people call you up and think that their house is haunted and you go investigate, what's the percentage of actual hauntings to not haunted?
Well, in a lot of cases, when people call and they want us to come out and, you know, there's a really good chance that while we're there, nothing is going to happen. Now, that doesn't mean that the house isn't haunted. It just maybe means that things weren't active that night. So that's why it's so important for people to keep, you know, a journal or notes on exactly what happens and when. That way, if, you know, something is happening on a regular basis, we've got a better idea of when to go to their house and, you know, and see if there's anything going on. And we've also got an idea of that, you know, there seems to be something going on here, but it's not going on tonight. And unfortunately, you know, percentage-wise, probably 90% of the time when you go out to somebody's house, there's probably nothing that's going to happen. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not haunted. It just means that things are not active at the time, and you may have to come back again. So that's, you know, unfortunately, happens quite a lot.
So besides the tours, what other sort of projects are you working on?
Well, it's besides the tours and the books, that's enough to keep me pretty busy. So that right there keeps me pretty busy. I usually have some other things going on. We do overnight trips to different places, haunted places where people can spend the night around the country. I'm also involved in a show called Cringe with the iClips Network. It's an online series. It's going to be distributed later this year by Microsoft, so it'll be all over the internet. And it's sort of a little history show about ghosts, where we actually go to different locations and, you know, tell the history behind the location. We do interviews with some of the people involved and really get to the background of the story. And then we film a live ghost hunt, and that's all part of the show. And we filmed a couple of episodes last year, and then we got back into it, came off hiatus, and we're really filming a lot of episodes now. So it's something to just kind of keep an eye on when you're on the website.
And again, if people want to visit your website, where should they go?
They can go to prairieghosts.com, or if they can't spell that, they can go to americanhauntings.org, and it all goes to the same place.
That was Troy Taylor, a writer, tour guide, and ghost hunter from the American Ghost Society. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.